Hi everyone, welcome to the Book Lounge. Today we are talking about Educated by Tara Westover. Your hosts, as always, are myself, Corinne Ritchie.
And me, Tom Butler-Bowden. And as you know by now, each week we look at a great nonfiction book and discuss it and dissect it and chat about it with our guest. And as Book Insights curator, I'll give my take on the book, what I felt about it and why I think it's relevant.
And I will also give my two cents on the book and update you on the latest news about the title and the author. So for in-depth knowledge about this book, we recommend two things. One, this podcast is brought to you by Memoed, so be sure to check out the savable, shareable 10-point memo on this book. You'll find a link to it in the show notes. And we also recommend that you listen to our Book Insights episode on this book. That's going to be a more detailed summary, overview, and analysis of the book. But here in the Book Lounge, it's more of just an informal chat about the book of the week. This week, we are bringing on a guest who is the assistant professor of history at Loyola University in Maryland, along with being a published author and blogger. He wrote an excellent piece titled Reading Tara Westover's Educated as a Professor. We are really pleased to welcome Professor Dr. Andrew Ross.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. Now, most people come to this book as a general reader, hearing about it through friends, etc. I presume the same thing happened with you. How did you first hear about this book, Educated?
That is exactly how I first heard about it. lots of people were recommending it to me. Memoir is not normally my genre of choice. So it really took a number of people just mentioning it over and over again. And I'm so glad that I came to it. I mean, it was also, if I recall, on a number of best books of the year, list, that sort of thing. So certainly glad that people pushed me to pick it up.
That's right. And so why are memoirs not your typical genre? Why do you usually steer clear? I'm just curious.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this because I had a feeling this might come up. I think sometimes they are too much about the kind of special individual, right? That they're the story of the one person who overcame the odds. And to some extent, this is that book. But what I really appreciate about Westover as an author is that she recognizes the ways in which she's kind of captured in systems and structures, and that those might affect other people differently, and that, it's not simply being the best person that enables you to kind of exceed them, but rather luck plays a lot, plays a big role as well. As a historian, I'm really interested in the ways that the world constrains us as much as it enables us to achieve. And memoirs often are more on the achievement end than the structure end, I guess is the way I'd put it.
So superhero stories, not your genre.
As escapism, I guess, right? As fantasy, I guess is the way to put it. Absolutely.
Well, I think you've touched on something very interesting here, because a lot of the books that we've done on this Book Insights show are sort of classic personal development, self-help genres, sort of books like either How I Made It or How I Came Back from Adversity. And now I'm very glad we've got you on as an academic historian, because as you said, this, on one hand, this is very much a sort of How I Triumphed Over Adversity memoir. But it's also a lot in there about storytelling and memory and conflicting accounts. So I guess that sort of thing must have made you enjoy it more, or could you sort of pull back and just enjoy it as a book, or were you just thinking of it in terms of like a historian's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, always both when reading anything of this sort. I mean, I really appreciate, you can tell she's also an historian, right? That she wasn't willing to hide the fact that her memory might not be correct, right? That there's always these multiple layers, or not always, but often these multiple layers that are going. And even, the very first page acknowledges this is one possible narrative of this of the story. And then she includes footnotes basically saying, my account differs from these others. And so readers get a real sense of how a historian does their job, right? That even when it's a single personal narrative, we're always constructing the story, we're not discovering it, right? There's not just one story to be found, but rather multiple versions of the same story that can be equally true in many respects. So I just really appreciated that she didn't shy away from that, which I think also memoir often does, right? It's supposed to be this one narrative, this clear cut kind of, this is what happened. And, you know, perhaps it's somewhat unfair to the genre, but she, I think, does a very good job of avoiding that. That pitfall for the most part. So I really appreciate it. And it's not like this, for those who haven't read it, it's not filled with footnotes, but there are enough to kind of, make you aware of the process of constructing the book.
Well, and that is a big differentiator because, you know, we've covered other memoirs on this show and none of them have footnotes at all, not even a single one. Yeah. You know, they just, it's just their own personal account or them and their editor's account of what their life has been up to that point. And that's it. And there's no regard for cross verification of anything. It's just, this is my story as I see it, and that's it, and that's enough. So Tara Westover definitely goes above and beyond to, like you said, give a historical account rather than just musings.
Absolutely.
Well, for people who haven't read the book, it's probably not many now, but
right.
I think it was the best-selling book of the year. Was it 2019, whenever it came out? For those who haven't, it's basically the story, Tara grows up with like Mormon survivalist parents in rural Idaho, somewhere called Buck's Peak. And, she has to work in her dad's junkyard. She doesn't go to school until well into her teens. Her family doesn't believe in going to the doctor. Her dad is very much anti anything to do with government, believes it's like a socialist plot. So it's totally isolated background that she grows up in. And then gradually a few things happen. There's like, you know, four or five books in the house and she reads them. She saves up to buy textbooks. So she gets some sense that there is this bigger world beyond Buck's Peak. For me, it just, you know, grabs me from the word go. You know, what's going to happen to her? Is she going to get out? How's she going to deal with all this stuff? In terms of the actual story, Andrew, what sort of grabbed you the most? What sort of kept you reading?
I mean, that number of things. One is just the question, what is going to happen here? Because the situation is so intense and unusual. I mean, it really is in some sense a thriller. I mean, she is in a situation that, in its extremes, is hard to look away from, right? I mean, there are moments of this book that are kind of gross. They're out of a horror movie in many respects. So, you know, the construction of the sense of, like, momentum of, like, what is actually going to happen is quite incredible in the book. For me, though, it's part two of the book that is particularly interesting when she arrives at college and her experience and, like, is she going to decide to leave this family or not? Right. And that becomes kind of the central question for me, keeping me going. What is a substantial book, a little over 300 pages? But it's that central question when we get about halfway through that really kept me engaged.
Yeah. Well, you wrote a very good article on the book, from a professor's perspective. And I think one of the moments in the book that's resonated with a lot of people is, I think it's sort of her early lectures at Brigham Young. And it's the first time she's discovered this word Holocaust. And, she asks about it. And, of course, other students can't believe that she's never heard about it. Obviously this is a story about the incredible diversity of students at college and university. But I was just wondered sort of how and why that might have resonated with you as well.
Yeah. I mean, it specifically resonated because that happened to me as a professor, where I literally had a student. This was at my previous institution, University of Southern Mississippi, where a student had not heard of Adolf Hitler, and was in my office and asked me who Adolf Hitler was. And I think at that point I'd been teaching for about 5 years in higher education, not always at USM, but this had never happened to me before. And I did not know how to respond. And I do not think I responded well. I basically said, have you done the reading? She said, no. And, you know, one question that you might then ask is, well, do you know how to do the reading? Should we talk about strategies for engaging with the textbook, with the material, rather than what I actually did, which essentially kicked her out of my office and said, go do the reading. Because I was so taken aback by her not knowing who Adolf Hitler was. And especially, you know, as a Jewish person living in the Deep South, this was particularly shocking, I have to say. So when I came to that scene in this book, I just was totally taken aback, because it almost the exact same thing, right? And the lesson that, you know, I have come to learn is that we as professors, as educators, cannot assume anything about our students. The landscape of higher education is changing to such a degree that you are going to get at all institutions students who are very well prepared. But, or let me say, most institutions who are very well prepared and others who are simply not. And it's our job to teach both those students. And therefore, it's our obligation to come in not with expectations, right? Most of our students will know what the Holocaust was. And I certainly hope most will continue to do so. But, you know, research is showing that that's not always the case, right? That knowledge of the Holocaust by entering freshmen is declining over, you know, over time. So it's my job to fix that, not to assume they already know. So it's just, you know, I lived that moment from the other side of the room.
And I think you used this word hidden curriculum.
Yes, yes.
A lot of assumed knowledge that people take with them to college, mm-hmm. or a lot of stuff that we can't assume.
Exactly.
And a massive amount of that has to do with parenting, right? There's a lot of stuff we don't get taught in high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it has to do with class, right? So were you part of a community where how to take the SAT was clear, right? If you look at research on things like standardized testing and the racial disparities, right? Like that is... You know, they're not measuring actual knowledge. They're measuring, do you know the codes, right? And so when students enter university, we should teach the codes, right? That education is not simply about content. It's about playing the game. And Tara Westover, when she enters the university, she not only doesn't know what the Holocaust is, but she doesn't know the difference between a 100 level and a 300 level course. Well, why should she, right? Why? You don't do that even if she went to public high school. You don't necessarily do that in high school. So why should an incoming freshman know that automatically? We assume they do because most professors are from, have backgrounds where their parents went to college, right? Or, you know, possibly their grandparents. As my, you know, my grandparents all went to college. That's not most Americans' experience. So why should I assume that they should know, my advisees, what the difference is between an upper division and lower division courses? And that's the hidden syllabus. And I really give credit to my colleague, Namisha Barton, for really helping me learn about, you know, what this is and the need to be as explicit as possible about expectations and what it means to be a college student going forward. But that was a learning process, right? That's not something you come out of grad school, you get your first job if you're lucky, and you know how to teach. It's something that you, or at least I, had to gradually come to and understand. Because it's not easy, because I don't always know what needs to be taught, right? And that's the real challenge here. And I really recommend this book to all my colleagues, because I think it really teaches, it can teach professors how to teach in many regards.
Yeah, I think that is one of the great things about this book is it opens your eyes to a whole world that you may not know is out there. Mm-hmm. And that, just like you said, your life may intersect with at some point, whether they're your student, a friend, you know, you just never know when worlds may collide that you had no idea existed. And that's some of my favorite nonfiction books are the ones that are so different that they make it feel like fiction. Like, it's nonfiction, but it feels like fiction because, like you said, it's gripping. It keeps you on the edge of your seat. You don't know what's going to happen. And in the back of your mind, the whole time you're thinking, I cannot believe that this is real. Mm-hmm. Like, this is somebody's real life experience. But that's really interesting to hear how, you know, your life intersected with someone else's who, you know, was so vastly different that they had never even heard of Hitler. And a big part of the book is sort of her changing her values and sort mm-hmm. of taking the reins of her own life and destiny and values. And as a professor, I'm wondering how on the front lines have you been of seeing students change their values, shift their values, and figure out what their own lives are going to look like? Because I feel like, if anyone, you might be there right in the midst of that important part of their life.
Yeah, and that's in some ways the best part of this job, seeing them grow. You know, right now, at least here in the States, there's this big debate over, you know, critical race theory and quote unquote indoctrination and that sort of thing. And that's a really, you know, putting aside the content of what critical race theory is, it's a profound misunderstanding about what our job is in the classroom when it comes to teaching students. It's not about making sure that students leave the classroom sharing my values, but rather understanding how to come to their own values, right? How to think critically about the world around them, how to understand the difference between a low quality and a high quality piece of evidence in order to come to their own conclusions, to understand how history continues to function in the present, and again, to come to their own conclusion. We're trying to teach, you know, how to make full human beings, right? And what's interesting about Westover is that, you know, she doesn't simply come to the values of those around her, right, or of her professors, but rather it's this constant give and take between what she thinks she wants, what they seem to expect, and finding something, not necessarily in between, but some combination of those, right? She doesn't leave Brigham Young and as an atheist, right? Or as even what would make more sense, as a more devout Mormon, since the people she encounters at Brigham Young are fairly devout, right? The conversation about polygamy, for instance, that occurs late in the book. So it's that seems more real to me, that she takes her experiences and comes to her own conclusion rather than simply saying, oh, well, my advisor believes this. This is what I believe. Right. Mm. And I really appreciated that about the book.
Yeah. And for a long time, though, she is totally torn between two worlds, isn't she? Mm-hmm. Like, she's going back and forth between college and home for a while. And when she's in college, she sort of feels more sophisticated and, you know, she's starting to, you know, learn about things like conversation and having a glass of wine and mm-hmm. even things like taking Tylenol when she's, you know, has some mild pain, which of course is banned at home. And then so there's this massive back and forth and living in two worlds. And again, I think this is something that must be experienced by a lot of people, particularly if you're the first in your family ever to have gone to university. This whole world, the same thing, you know, I don't know if you've read Hillbilly Elegy. Okay, well, it's, you know, it's a similar sort of thing coming from a totally different world, non-middle class world, and being thrown into the university environment. And, you know, I think with Westover and J.D. Vance, it's like people can be torn apart by this movement from one mm-hmm. world to the other. And I wonder if, you know, if universities are sort of prepared or set up to really help people like that.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I mean, you know, there are certain areas of university life where we are the parents, right? That we are supposed to kind of replace the parents, but you can't, right? That's actually, it's impossible to do that. And so what I see as our job is creating the environment with which they can make their own decisions about what kind of life, you know, they ultimately want to have. I mean, the extremes of someone like Vance or Westover, I think are relatively unique, but certainly, especially first generation students might find themselves quite out to sea when they enter university. I mean, one issue or one question I have about Westover's story and what she encounters first at Brigham Young and then at Cambridge and in Harvard is, and I'm curious what you guys think, is why is she so intent on maintaining those connections back home, right? Why is it necessary for her to do so? And I don't have a firm conclusion on this, whether she should or should not. But I do think about, like, all kinds of people have to construct families that are not their biological family, right? And I think especially about queer communities, right? And that, you know, we have always created new families. And so why for her is that kind of an impossibility? I mean, she does eventually meet with her, her aunt, right? And she reconnects with her two brothers who are also leaving the family. And that's another, that the family itself is splitting in two. But I think it's her first boyfriend, Charles, who is just like, why are you still trying? Like, why don't you just leave? And it's a great question. I'm not sure I have an answer to it. And so that, you know, that's another response, Tom, to your own question, which is, well, why try, right? Why not just leave one world and enter another? And I mean, I think I know why that would be hard, but I'm not sure it's necessarily, like, it's necessarily obvious that you shouldn't try to just leave one for the other in the end.
Well, for such a long time, she didn't really socialize with other kids her age. She didn't go have normal school life. So she was isolated for so long that suddenly flicking a switch to, you know, creating another family, maybe that's a reason why it was just too hard for her. And I was the same when I was reading it. I just thought, why can't you just leave these people behind? But then there are bits where she says, you know, sometimes my dad's thing said things that, you know, had me like laughing for an hour. And, you know, there were some good points, obviously, in her experience. And I guess you only have one biological family, and to leave it behind, I mean, she obviously does love her siblings, mm-hmm. right? Even though she falls out with them, and some she takes with her and other ones she can't. Even Sean, like the guy who physically, mentally abuses her, you know, she's got some feeling for him. Mm-hmm. So in an ideal world, she would have left it all behind, but she is just emotionally, you know, unable to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you bring up a good point, Andrew, about sort of creating your own families when you realize that there's toxicity in your own, or there's rejection, or, you know, it's gotten to a point where you can no longer associate with your family of origin, and so you need to create your own. And, you know, having grown up seeing that, I think it makes a lot of sense. But if you have never seen that before, if you've mm-hmm. never experienced that, if, you know, she was so isolated that for her, all she knew was her family. And so she probably had no idea that creating your own family is possible, or that having deep, meaningful connections with people who you don't live with, who you didn't grow up with, like it's like you don't know what you don't know. And so to me, when I read it, I sort of thought that for her, it wasn't an option to disregard these people because she had never seen anything like that. I think she's sort of forging her own path and figuring mm-hmm. it out as she goes. And so to me, I kind of read it as she didn't even know that that was an option until, mm-hmm. you know, she's so far down the line, I guess. And even to this day, like you said, she still has relationships with some in the family. So I think there is that sense of, you know, when you have not associated with anyone else besides your family for more than half of your life, mm-hmm. Those ties are not easily broken, regardless of the dysfunction, I guess.
Yeah, and it takes a toll on her. All the mental strain sort of manifests in various physical symptoms and ailments and so on. But again, she's sort of caught in this thing where, oh, I can't use, you know, conventional medicine that goes against my beliefs. And this is when she's like at Cambridge University and, you know, it's sort of mind-boggling the hold that history has on people. As you say, Corinne, I mean, it's just breaking free of that. You know, in theory, it should be easy and logical. But for many people, you know, it's just a step too far.
Yeah, when it's ingrained in there like that, it's really hard. A couple of quotes that stood out to me from this book, one of them was, whomever you become, whatever you make yourself into, that is who you always were. I love that because, you know, she's sort of helping us to understand that all of this was always within her. She just had to discover it, and it took, you know, this path of education, essentially, to help her find that piece of her that was always there that needed to just be nourished and allowed to flourish. And so I think as our listeners or our viewers on YouTube are watching this, hopefully, I know a lot of these stories we're sharing sound crazy, like somebody who, you know, is so isolated, they haven't been to a friend's house for, you know, till they're a teenager and don't take medicine and, you know, think the government's out to get them and, you know, preppers, all of that. It sounds far out, but there are some things that are really relatable, that really touch on the human experience. And so, you know, one of those is this whole concept of, you know, forging your path and discover and let that self-discovery piece. What do you think, Andrew? Stuff that stands out to or is relatable to everyone, something, you know, how do you see the approachability of this book?
Yeah, I think, you know, one way of reading the story is of, you know, how do you navigate a situation where you don't have the power? Because, you know, it's one. So one example, it's absolutely the case that this is a family that rejects modern medicine, right? Does not go to the doctor. They are not. They don't get their vaccines, their vaccinations. They totally reject that. And instead, the mother is a midwife for a time and also makes tinctures, right? Homeopathy. And, you know, one reading of that is like, she's a fraud, right? She's a fake. She's doing fake medicine. Blah, blah, blah. But the other read is that she is finding a way to gain power in this family milieu, right? She's the one making the money. She actually has a lot of knowledge. She saves the father's life after he is burned, right? I mean, that is a horrific scene, and they definitely should have gone to a hospital, but I would not have been able to save his life, right? So she has actual knowledge, even if it's a different kind of knowledge. And so what she has managed to do, even if she... You know, by the end of the novel, or my memoir, excuse me, I'm not really a big fan of the mom for a variety of reasons. She is an example of the kind of ways in which, even in the most extreme circumstances, you can find ways of what, you know, of finding agency, as we might say, right? The ability to push back against, in this case, an extremely misogynist, patriarchal family. But it's the mom who kind of implicitly runs the show through those kind of practices. And I think you see elements of this throughout the book. Like, how do you find ways of navigating a very difficult situation?
And Andrew's interested to know, drilling down a bit more into the sort of storytelling aspects of this memoir. What's very important to Tara is her journaling. So it's really her first form of writing. She writes copious journals. And as she is sort of depicting events, she starts to, and then she, you know, asks her sisters their memory what happened, and it's slightly different. And then she starts to doubt herself, well, am I remembering correctly? And it seemed to me that her journaling is like a sort of proto history, like it's this is how history evolved originally, like people just describing events And then over time, it turns into history, capital H, you know, as historians writing, etc. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering how you sort of think about that gap between personal history and, you know, university academic history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she's in a unique situation because she's both historian and subject of the historian, right? So her journals are both the first draft of the story, but also the primary source. And as the primary source, I think she recognizes that they can't always be trusted. And sometimes that becomes toxic, right? Towards the end, Tom, you were mentioning this moment where she's being gaslighted by her family, right? That she is basically saying, my brother Sean has abused us. And they're saying, no, he didn't. And the journals aren't enough to convince her, right? She needs someone else to kind of come in and say, no, what you experienced and what is down there actually happened. And so even though she's the author of the primary source, she still needs the kind of outside verification. And that's what a historian does, right? And so it's interesting to me that even though she's the author of the source material, she still, and again, not always for good reasons, because her family is lying to her over and over and over again, she still needs to get that kind of verification. And still needs to kind of, you know, line it up with what other people experienced. You know, just regarding the journals, I think it's clear that the fact that she journaled so regularly is part of why this book was possible, right? And it's just an amazing accomplishment that she was able to really teach herself how to write. So, you know, she first encounters like an English comp class and she doesn't know what an essay was. Well, she kind of did. She just didn't know the term, right? Because at least that's my read of this. I also just, you know, in preparation for our chat, just, you know, did a quick Google of the book just to read a bit of the background. And I think her family members have challenged her quite a bit on the how accurate the book is. And I don't think it's relevant how accurate the book is, but it was fact-checked, right? This is a book that had editors that went and, you know, did some actual fact-checking. So the journals aren't just the source. I think we should, you know, that there was a whole apparatus set up around the book to ensure that what is being said is at least one truth at least so far as, I don't know who the publisher is, so far as this publisher was, Random House, is concerned.
Yeah, well, and you know, it does make me wonder, because you mentioned the power dynamics, and with the push and pull from her siblings and her family about what's true, what's not, it makes me wonder if we are just seeing, sort of on the macro level now with the book reception, more of those power dynamics, more of what was going on in the home of, you know, letting your family know this is what's happening and them just soundly rejecting your experience, mm-hmm. and substituting it with their own, with the narrative that, you know, the dad primarily is pushing and then the oldest sibling is pushing and eventually mom is pushing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see that in stories in the book. And then once the book comes out, we see it on the big scale about the book's veracity. So, mm-hmm. you know, just seems like more of the same, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, so one narrative that might have happened was she writes this book, she's a PhD, and now she's the elite, right? She is, and one could read it as she's taking advantage of this family, right? By telling the story, even though everyone is it's all pseudonyms. We don't have their real names, although I'm sure if I really cared, I could find, you know, I believe she's really named Tara Westover, so you could find out. But what actually happened by the end of the book is this is a powerful family. Like, they are not just like, it's, you know, we call them survivalists because they are, but they are making a lot of money. They are deeply connected to their community. Like, they're not just like sitting out on the mountain anymore, like isolated. They have a new kind of power that they didn't have at the beginning of the book. So it's not like Tara Westover is just like taking advantage of this rustic family who's living out by themselves, but rather she's telling the story of, you know, a family that has achieved something in their own right. And the conflict is much more complicated, I think, than it otherwise might have been had that not occurred. And again, that's the mom's doing. She saved the father's life. That becomes a myth. and now they're selling, I almost said snake oil, but that's, I don't think that's quite right. Tinctures and homemade remedies.
A cottage business. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole sort of question of success, as you're sort of intimating, comes up here. She's become successful through education. Other members of family become successful through businesses and so on. So again, it's an interesting twist on the sort of conventional triumph over adversity memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, every time we discuss a book, we sort of give a slightly cheesy rating or bookmark out of five and say why. Corinne, would you like to begin?
Sure. So I will give this book 5 out of 5 bookmarks. I think they're, everything I look for in a book is in this book. I can see why, you know, book clubs all over the world and the country are devouring this book and talking about it. I feel like I could talk about it for hours because there's just so much to it. It's gripping, it's inspiring, it's educational, motivational, touching. You know, this podcast is all about life-changing nonfiction, and this is reading about somebody's life changing, but I also challenge anyone to read this and your own life not changing, because, you know, there's just so much to it that is so moving. So yeah, I give it a 5. There's nothing I could change to make this a better read. I recommend it to people all the time.
Andrew?
I can only agree. If I'm forced to give it a rating, it would be a 5 out of 5. This book astounded me, I have to say. And, you know, again, just in compare, I reading other memoirs often for teaching, this one is complicated. It understands its own kind of position as a memoir and what that means. No matter where you are in your own educational path, you'll find something to pull out of it. And it's beautifully written, and it is. It's a page turner. You can really sit down you read it in a day, you might have trouble putting it down. It's really a wonderful book.
Yeah, well, I give it a 5 as well. It's the best sort of nonfiction that reads like a novel. And it's in this great tradition of memoir, you know, that I mentioned, Hillbilly Elegy. But, you know, another favorite memoir, Catherine Graham's Personal History. Slightly similar in that she says, Catherine Graham, this is my recollection of events. And she tried to fact check everything. But someone from a completely different world, someone who sort of had everything, even at the beginning, and then becomes more successful, rich, famous, etc. So I'm just fascinated by the genre of memoir, period. And I just think, you know, this is one of the best, really, you know, of the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. And, you know, they made that Hillbilly Elegy movie. I'm just waited for Educated, the movie, like at least the documentaries. Give me something. You know?
I have no doubt that is happening.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I researched the title and the author to kind of see, and that's what I was looking for. I'm like, all right, who's got the rights? Who's producing this? And, you know, I didn't find anything. So our listeners and viewers, if you guys find anything, let me know, because I really am anxiously waiting for Educated on the big screen, the little screen, some kind of screen. Give me something.
Yeah.
So today, Educated has sold over 4 million copies, and that's since its release in 2018. So it's not even that old, and 4 million copies. Since then, Tara's been speaking about her experience at universities. She's been on Ellen, she's spoken with Bill Gates and Oprah, and she's making the rounds talking about her story, her book, and her life. Today, she's a senior research fellow at Harvard, and currently she's studying the link between media and political polarization. So I'm curious and interested to hear how that sits with her. And like you said, Andrew, she is a historian in some sense. So I'm interested to see how her journey evolves with her academic research. And for those who don't know, Tara's mother, Laurie, actually self-published her own book titled Educating, and that gives her perspective, and along with the perspective of her husband, Val, as they basically attempt to discredit much of Tara's book. So they call it dramatization, they call it exaggeration, but they also don't fact check their book as Tara did, and they omit huge portions of what she mentions. So, you know, just so you know that both stories are out there, and there are a few people who are actually reviewing both, reading Educated and then reading Educating, and then kind of reviewing the two side by side. So definitely lots out there.
Yes. Well, Andrew, is there anything else you wanted to say about this book or your experience of it, or a sort of last word?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm interested that she's turning towards questions of political polarization, because the end of this book is essentially about that, where you have three members of this family who have PhDs. I mean, it is a kind of an incredible family, and three, or actually more, siblings who are staying on the mountain, right, and have knocked on the school. And in many respects, that's the story of our contemporary situation, where education itself is becoming as much an indicator as anything else of how you vote. So I will be very interested to see her next project.
That is a fascinating point to end on, because it makes me think of this book, maybe we'll do it in Book Insights, by Michael Sandel, The Tyranny of Merit. And it's all about the idea of meritocracy, you know, which is Tara's story, going from, you know, nothing to Harvard, whatever. And which is great that there is this possibility. But the people who don't go on that journey, it often leaves a very hollow feelings of inferiority, which makes people vulnerable to polarization and populism, etc. So this is a whole nother sort of angle that the book opens that you mentioned, that is fascinating, that no doubt, you know, a lot of people are exploring.
Yeah, that's a great point, that education, for all the good that it did in Tara's life, I'm sure with her family, it was this line in the sand of, you know, now I'm on this side, and it becomes this us versus them kind of situation. So I can see how she would be drawn into that concept and sort of studying that idea of where that polarization comes from, what feeds into it, what helps against it. And I would be curious about that as well. So, Andrew, if folks want to connect with your blog, with you, with your work, where can they find you?
So you can go to my website, which is andrewisraelross.com, and follow me on Twitter at AIRoss, that's R-O-S-S, zero. You can also read my book, which is A History of Homosexuality and Prostitution in 19th Century Paris, called Public City, Public Sex. It was published by Temple University Press a couple years ago.
Awesome. Well, we'll be sure to add links in the show notes to all of the places you mentioned to connect with you. So Great. Thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate your time.
No, thank you. This was a real pleasure.
Yeah. And also, people listening, we've got a 10-point memo on Educated. So if you've never come across it before, never really read it, or you don't have time to, check out our memo on the book.
Yep. And as always, be sure to listen to the Book Insights episode, which is, again, a more detailed summary, overview and analysis of the book. So be sure to check out that episode. And connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Book Insights Pod. All right. Well, that wraps it up. I hope our viewers on YouTube and our listeners will tune in again next week. Every week we talk about a new life-changing nonfiction book. A huge thank you again to you, Andrew. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.